It is Monday, August the 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, in light of a deadly wedding blast in Turkey, some insight into what's happening.
What Erdogan has done is he's told the Turks something very hard to understand, that ISIS, the Kurds, and the Gulenists are all the same.
Also ahead, the threat from the Zika virus, plus many days of Olympics fun coming to an end, and a famed American crooner is honored. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Turkey is in shock following the bombing at a wedding ceremony, killing at least 50 people, wounding more than 90. That attack in the city of Gaziantep, close to the Syrian border, is being blamed on the Islamic State militants. Dorian Jones in Istanbul has our report.
All through Saturday night, ambulances rushed the wounded to hospitals across Gaziantep. Witnesses say a suicide bomber detonated explosives in a packed street of people dancing and celebrating a wedding. Along with children, the bride and groom are reported to be among the dead in Turkey's worst terror attack this year. Speaking the day after the attack, while surveying the damage, local resident Ibrahim Özdemir says people are in shock.
Çevre eş dostlarımızdan vardı, işte komşularımız vardı. Üzüntülüyüz, acı içerisindeyiz.
Our friends and neighbors were there. We are so sad and in pain. The attack is an atrocity, he said. We want to end these massacres. We are in pain, especially the women and children. Shortly after the attack, Deputy Prime Minister Mehmet Şimşek flew to Gaziantep, the city he represents. Şimşek took a defiant stance.
Bunlar yine huzur içerisinde hep birlikte.
The aim of terror is to scare the people, but we will not allow this, he said, adding that a suicide bombing was the likely cause. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said IS was the chief suspect, accusing the group of targeting Turkey's Kurdish minority and seeking to create ethnic divisions within the country. The wedding was attended by many Kurds in a Kurdish part of the city. Syrian Kurdish forces have inflicted a number of recent defeats on the jihadist group. IS was blamed for a series of suicide bombings of Kurdish targets, including the country's worst terror attack in the capital, Ankara, in October, in which nearly 100 people died while attending a pro-Kurdish rally. Gaziantep, where the latest attack occurred, is less than an hour's drive to the Syrian border and has been a main hub for jihadists entering Syria and for logistical support. In May, Islamic State was blamed for a suicide car bombing of the city's security headquarters. IS has not claimed responsibility for Saturday's bombing, but analysts say the group has a record of not doing so for bombings in Turkey. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And for some perspective on what's happening in Turkey, including this weekend's attack in Gaziantep and previous attacks in Ankara and Istanbul, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with University of Pennsylvania scholar Ian Lustig, who takes into account the recent failed coup, which Turkish leaders blame on followers of exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen, who lives in the U.S.
It's such a complicated situation, but I think it's possible to make a little sense out of it. What Erdogan has done is he's told the Turks something very hard to understand, that ISIS, the Kurds, and the Gulenists are all the same. They're enemies of Turkey. In reality, there are three completely different elements that Erdogan is fighting for completely different reasons. And most of the bombings that we've seen in the last few days that weren't as destructive as this last one, but were still deadly, were bombings by Kurds in the southeast of Turkey, where Kurds are the majority. And there is a vicious war going on there between the Turkish government and the Kurds. This attack by ISIS is something very different. It's an attack on the Kurds. Erdogan doesn't really want to say it's an attack on the Kurds, because that would undermine his argument that the Kurdish rebels and political parties and the ISIS and the Gulenists are all one big enemy. They're all the same. Now, that's why it's so confusing to try to understand Turkey by listening just to what Erdogan is saying.
Well, you seem to understand it. Do others?
You know, yes, others do. I've been in communication with Turkish, with experts on Turkey in the United States, and with experts in Turkey, that is, Turkish political scientists and others, and they've helped me come to understand it. But I believe that there's, even among the most well-informed, there are dispute about what the Gulenists, who the Gulenists are, what role did they play, what, how far will Erdogan go, whether it's really more dangerous for Turkish democracy to let Erdogan purge the Islamic movement of these of this organization, or to let the organization exist and fight it out with Erdogan in legal politics. It's such a rapidly changing landscape in Turkey that many people are confused about it. I might say that we haven't even talked about the international level. That is, at the same time that all these domestic issues are occurring, Erdogan is reaching out to Putin in Russia to forge an alliance and to make a reversal from his hostile stand against Russia. Remember, the Turks shot down a Russian airplane when it strayed over Turkish territory. And Turkey is a member of NATO. Well, as a member of NATO, the idea that it would form an alliance with Russia is potentially very distressing to the United States. And we also see a rapidly changing position that Erdogan has taken towards Syria. It's not clear whether he wants to escalate his commitment to get involved in Syria, and if he does, is he now, in fact, retreating from his traditional stance of wanting to get rid of Assad to now perhaps being willing, working with the Russians, to allow Assad to remain in some capacity in order to stabilize Syria and relieve the threats against Turkey? So, as I said, it is, as you said, a very complicated situation.
Any idea how it's going to play out?
How it's going to play out? No, not in any specific way. I do think that ISIS is on the downslide. They are suffering now. It reverses, but that doesn't mean that they can't lash out in extremely destructive ways, as they showed with this last attack. I think that there's a limit to what Erdogan can do with Russia if he wants to remain in NATO, and I think he realizes he would take a tremendous risk in Turkey if he decided to abandon NATO. I don't really think he's going to do that, and it might be an important decision by the United States to know when and how to draw the line with him, to tell him if you go any further in these directions, you will not be able to stay in NATO.
Are you expecting more bombings like what occurred on the...
Unfortunately, I am expecting more violence, and I think more violence from more quarters, including those who will sympathize with the tens of thousands of Turkish civil servants and military officers who are now being imprisoned. Erdogan released over 30,000 prisoners just to make room for all those he's been purging from the upper ranks of Turkish civil society. This is very hard to predict where this is going to end.
Ian Lustig is a professor of comparative international relations at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also author of numerous publications, including the book Trapped in the War on Terror. Dr. Lustig was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. And among the other stories we're following here on The Voice of America, Al-Shabaab attack killing at least 17 in Somalia, plus President Duterte's threats to withdraw the Philippines from the United Nations. More on those stories, plus a lot more, at voanews.com and, as always, on the VOA mobile app. Experts are saying the Zika virus will remain active in the United States maybe as long as two more years, with the Gulf Coast states being the most vulnerable. Dr. Anthony Fauci is chief of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases.
I would not be surprised if we see cases in Texas and Louisiana, particularly now where you have the situation with flooding in Louisiana. There's going to be a lot of problems getting rid of standing water. When you have a subtropical or semi-tropical region with the right mosquitoes and individuals who have travel-related cases that are in the environment, it would not be surprising that we will see additional cases, not only in Florida, but perhaps in other of the Gulf Coast states.
U.S. Centers for Disease Control has warned pregnant women to avoid popular areas in the state of Florida, where 7 suspected Zika cases were discovered last week. The mosquito-borne Zika has been linked to severe birth defects, one called microcephaly in pregnant women, in which babies are born with abnormally small heads and underdeveloped brains. Dr. Fauci just mentioned the possibility of the Zika outbreak in the U.S. state of Louisiana, which has been dealing with expansive flooding. About 3,200 people there remain in shelters. International Edition's Lori London speaks now with Mike Steele. He is spokesman for the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness about the impact of the flooding there and the numbers of people affected.
The registration count's already up to 102,000. So technically, if that was all done properly, that's one person per household. Mm. So it's hard for us to determine exactly how many people are in each household. But, you know, there's quite a few.
It sounds pretty catastrophic from what we're hearing as far as people literally being displaced.
It is pretty devastating. I was a television reporter when Katrina and Rita hit, and I thought that was about as bad as it could get. This looks very similar in some areas to Katrina. And so, you know, that's kind of the same comments you hear from a lot of people as they go around and look at some of the areas. I personally live in Livingston Parish, which was one of the hardest hit areas. And kind of being in the Denham Springs area and some of the areas in Livingston Parish reminded me a lot of being in some of the places right outside of New Orleans after Katrina.
What does it look like?
Just total, you know, devastation. There's piles of debris everywhere as people try to, you know, got everything out of their homes to help with the mold fight and to get everything cleaned out properly. And then, you know, a lot of the major shopping centers in Denham Springs are completely shut down. There's a large home improvement store right off the interstate, and they're talking about running operations out of the parking lot just to help people with things like sheetrock and lumber and different things they may need, because they estimate it could be 6 or 8 weeks before that store gets reopened. But there's a couple of other newer, you know, brand new major shopping centers that are completely shut down right now.
Any idea how long it will take to recover from something like this?
It's going to be months. And you know, it's hard to tell exactly. You still have standing water in some areas right now. And luckily, those are some areas that, you know, with a smaller population. But, you know, it's still just as devastating to those people. But, you know, we're definitely talking about a long recovery process here. So, you know, we're trying to make sure we keep everybody focused. One of the things we were fortunate to have was that literally as the rain was still falling, FEMA already had some key people on the ground with us. So they were able to go out and take some early, like, you know, they were getting a look at some of these areas that were obviously devastated by these floods. And so we were able to get the presidential declaration very early. So that was kind of key to us. And even though it was only 4 parishes to begin with, anybody in the state that was impacted by this could start that registration process.
I understand the forecast is calling for more rain. How concerned is your agency about that?
Well, we've had rain almost every afternoon since the flooding stopped. So that definitely adds a few more challenges onto what we're doing. This is a time of year when you see a lot of pop-up thunderstorms, you know, start to hit the state. We have the threat of tropical weather that we're still, you know, keeping an eye on. And as a matter of fact, the governor's already made all of the key agencies start having meetings on, okay, what if we're dealing with this and we have to start dealing with the threat of a tropical system? Like, how are we going to address it? So those conversations have already started. And, you know, there's no guarantee that you couldn't have another very large event. We have thunderstorms here can cause, you know, severe damage at times. We pretty much have to stay ready for anything. And then there's a number of industrial sites, you know, all over the state, especially South Louisiana. And so, you know, you could always have some type of new problem, you know, compound the current problem.
Mike Steele, a spokesperson for the Governor's Office of Homeland Security. That's in the U.S. state of Louisiana. He was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
Do you know?
know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Host country Brazil and the world have said farewell to the first Olympic Games to be held in South America. Ed Hula, managing editor of the online site AroundTheRings.com, tells my colleague Victor Beatty Rio de Janeiro actually had a fairly successful event, even though many thought it might fail.
I think the gamble so far has paid off for Rio. We are here on the night of closing ceremonies, and lots of little problems have dogged the way over the past 17 days. But the games have finished with a glorious ending for Brazil on a unfortunately rainy night. But besides little problems, nothing big, nothing bad. And Rio, I think, has proved that it could host a version of the Olympic Games.
What lessons could possibly be learned from some of the small problems, the organizational mishaps, ticket fiascos, green water, street crime?
Well, you never know what will happen. You have to be prepared for a little bit of everything. To me, the biggest lesson for these Olympics is the scale, the distance required to go from one event to another, the time that you spend in transit going to events. And I think that might have helped make it more difficult for them to fill some of these stadiums for the events. The difficulty, the hassle factor, if you will.
That's Ed Hula of AroundTheRings.com. Final day of the Olympics featured 12 gold medal events, including men's basketball. The U.S. team easily coasted to gold in the matchup against Serbia, winning 96-66. VOA's Park Brewer was at Sunday's final, that is, and has this report from Rio de Janeiro.
While the U.S. men came into the championship game undefeated in 7 games in Rio, Serbia had lost to the Americans in group play here by only 3 points. In the first quarter of the gold medal match, it looked like it might be another close game. The Serbians held the lead a number of times in the early going, but just as the quarter ended, NBA superstar Kevin Durant hit a 3-pointer to give Team USA a 19-15 lead. Then in the second quarter, Durant took over the game, knocking down 4 more jump shots from long range.
Just woke up, I guess, and my teammates were supporting me. They were cheering me on along the way, and everybody was just encouraging me, and I just went out there and had fun with the game.
Durant scored 18 of his game-high 30 points in the second quarter, finishing the half with 24 as the Americans led 52-29. They were never threatened after the intermission, and in the fourth quarter even held a 41-point lead. Their 30-point margin of victory is the largest of any men's Olympic basketball final. Serbian coach Saša Đorđević said his team should be happy with the silver medal and that the U.S. is a better team.
The result at the end was 30 points. You know, we didn't want to go like that, but in the end we need to congratulate them. They're better. They showed that tonight.
Earlier Sunday, Spain edged Australia 89-88 in a thrilling game in which the lead changed hands 13 times in the last 5.5 minutes. The winning points for Spain came on free throws by Sergio Rodriguez. Park Brewer, VOA News at the Rio Olympics.
Yeah, great work there in Rio, Park. Thanks so much for everything. Now preparations underway in Tokyo for the next Summer Games. Those will be in 2020. Time now to see what's trending online with my colleague G. Abby Lee. Hi, G. What's happening?
Hi, Steve. The New York Post reported Hillary Clinton's top aide, Huma Abedin, worked at a quote-unquote radical Muslim journal for years. The publication is called the Journal of Muslim Minority Affairs, where she worked as the assistant editor. Her mother is the editor-in-chief. The article argued the publication opposed women's rights and blamed the U.S. for 9/11.
Yeah, I see. Gee, that could potentially help cement the Republican support for Clinton's rival Donald Trump. But it appears he's also a bit in the hot seat, right?
That's right. The New York Times reported Donald Trump's companies owe at least $650 million in debt. The report attempted to map out Trump's business empire and its web of assets, partnerships, loans, and debts. His campaign had reported the Trump Organization owed $350 million, so that's a whopping $334 million difference.
And as we know, with social media, there's always something else trending. What's out there?
Steve, we have to talk about the latest in the Rio Games. Two coaches for a Mongolian wrestler took off their clothes to protest a penalty point given to an Uzbek athlete that led him to winning the bronze medal. And the controversial point here is how they protest the official's decision. But on social media, it was explained by people who are familiar with the culture in Mongolia that stripping off clothes there means they feel cheated and robbed. So it's a way of saying, you took away everything that I have. Others still say it was a childish behavior nonetheless. But the general sentiment online seems to be that, well, it's a cultural difference. Steve, back to you.
Any way you look at it, G, it got our attention. Many thanks, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can find our program, International Edition, on Twitter at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
In November 2015, scientists discovered a Venus-like planet that's only 39 light-years away, called Gliese 1132b. The planet is thought to have an atmosphere despite having a blistering temperature of more than 230 degrees Celsius, since it orbits its red dwarf star from a distance of only 2.25 million kilometers. A new study suggests that the exoplanet's atmosphere is thick and dense and may contain a little oxygen too. Since the planet is so relatively close to its sun, scientists say it's being bombarded with ultraviolet light. This UV light can break down water molecules, separating them into hydrogen and oxygen. Since hydrogen is so light, it can easily escape into space, leaving some of the oxygen to stay behind. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us this Monday. It is time now for a little something from our music department. Dozens of children from San Francisco gathered in front of the Fairmont Hotel. That's atop Nob Hill to throw a big birthday bash for veteran entertainer Tony Bennett as he celebrates being 90. They were singing I Left My Heart in San Francisco. It's a song Tony Bennett made famous after performing it for the first time in public at the Fairmont in 1961. San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee declared it Tony Bennett Day.
We celebrate you here today for your part of our city's history. And now we immortalize you in bronze so that you'll be here forever, welcoming every person to our great city.
Just after Mayor Lee spoke, a 2.5 meter tall bronze statue of Bennett was unveiled. And U.S. House of Representative Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, who represents the San Francisco district, was on hand for that statue dedication.
When Tony was singing here in 1961, and just shortly thereafter, is when Paul Pelosi and I started dating on the East Coast. And my family in Baltimore, every time they heard Tony sing, I Left My Heart in San Francisco, so seductive was the song and his voice, they kept saying, oh, I think she's going to move to San Francisco. So Paul Pelosi had that as part of his courtship, Tony, and that's why he was happy to donate to the statue here today.
I'll never forget this day. Thank you very, very much.
The celebration of Tony Bennett continued at AT&T Park when the San Francisco Giants baseball team honored Bennett in a pregame ceremony and throughout the game. Bennett performed "I Left My Heart in San Francisco" for the fans, who get to hear it each time the Giants win a home game.
The loveliness of Paris seems somehow sadly gay. The glory that was Rome is of another day. But I was terribly alone and forgotten in Manhattan. I'm going home.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, wonderful. My heart's there right now. My body's here in Washington. My heart's in San Francisco. Hey, listen, thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now, a little bit more of Tony Bennett.
I'm halfway to the stars. The morning fog, they chill the air. I don't care, my love waits there. In San Francisco.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia Patricia Haslak participated in a signing ceremony in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, August 11, 2016, to award a Julia Taft Fund grant for refugees to International Rescue Committee Ethiopia. The U.S. government is proud to partner with government, international organizations, and NGOs like IRC to support Ethiopia as it hosts the largest population of refugees in Africa. The importance of Ethiopia as a key player in responding to refugee needs is highlighted by the fact that Ethiopia will serve as one of seven co-hosts for President Obama's Leaders Summit on Refugees that will be held on September 20th in conjunction with the 71st session of the UN General Assembly. The summit co-hosts all recognize that the international community must do more to protect and assist refugees. Massive numbers of refugees are embarking upon dangerous paths in search of safety, and millions more face long-term waits in first asylum countries with limited and, in some cases, no access to lawful employment and education while they wait for crises to end in their respective countries. In the lead-up to the UNGA, Ethiopia, the United States and other co-hosts, as well as other UN member states that join this effort, will make concrete commitments to address these challenges. In 2015, the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration provided nearly $82 million in refugee assistance in Ethiopia, and to date this year has provided over $66 million. Through its assistance in Ethiopia, the United States funding for IRC has allowed it to implement projects that have renovated facilities for the reception of children and adolescent refugees arriving in Ethiopia, developed livelihoods for refugees, and constructed a multipurpose women's center for counseling, training, and community activities. The Department of State is delighted that IRC is the recipient of this year's Julia Taft Fund Award in Ethiopia. This award of nearly $25,000 will boost the availability of safe drinking water and improved sanitation facilities for the 21,000-plus refugees, mostly from Sudan and South Sudan, who live in the Sor and Shekoli refugee camps. The U.S. government looks forward to continuing to fostering our partnership and commitment with IRC, as well as with our other NGO and international organization partners, to assist the refugee population in Ethiopia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.